30, having arrived, I'm going to call to order the Higher Education Finance and Policy Committee. Members, we have as the first item on the agenda a presentation by the Office of Higher Ed on the state grant program, and I think we have three possible testifiers coming down. So if they'd want to come down, and whoever wishes to go first, welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Chair Pulaski and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Wendy Robinson, and I'm the Assistant Commissioner at the Office of Higher Education. Today we are here to talk in more depth about the upcoming changes to the federal financial aid application, the FAFSA, and how those changes will impact our process for awarding Minnesota state grant and other state financial aid programs. We talked about this a bit when OHI was presenting earlier in the session, so I'll just give a kind of quick recap about some of the changes that are coming. As you may recall, these changes are arising from the 2020 FAFSA Simplification Act, which is a piece of legislation that was really designed with the intent of trying to make FAFSA easier to complete for students and families by reducing the number of questions and eliminating some of the historical barriers that some students have faced as they've tried to access federal financial aid programs. Some of those changes include removing questions around previous drug offense convictions and selective service registration. Some of those changes are including making incarcerated students eligible for Pell Grants. It restores Pell Grant lifetime eligibility for students from closed or fraudulent schools. It no longer considers the number of household members in college for the SAI or Pell calculation. It also will shift for some students who have divorced or separated parents, which parents' information and income they will be required to report as part of the FAFSA. The largest and most significant change, however, is the conversion from the expected family contribution, or EFC, to a new measure called the Student Aid Index, or SAI. As you may remember, if you've done a FAFSA at some point in your past, the EFC is kind of that magic number that determines what kinds of financial aid a student might be eligible for. It's simplest to remember that the lower the student's EFC, the higher the amounts of need-based aid that they'll qualify for, like the Pell Grant. It'll determine whether they qualify for work study, if they qualify for subsidized or unsubsidized loans. In the past formula, the EFC bottomed out at zero. That was the lowest possible measure you could get. In the upcoming SAI index, that will be changed to having a possible minimum number of minus 1,500. And that shift from zero to minus 1,500 actually has a number of implications, both in terms of how our processes work in terms of awarding aid for students, and is ultimately designed to make sure that our most high-need students are able to access as much financial aid as they're eligible for. FAFSA simplification impacts state aid programs in several ways. One of the decisions that Minnesota has made in the past when setting up our state financial aid programs was to not have a separate application and to use the information from the FAFSA. Again, it's a great opportunity to save students a step and reduce a barrier. So because we use FAFSA in lieu of requiring that separate application, anything that changes at the federal level in terms of FAFSA formulas or awarding processes, we need to make sure that we are congruent and consistent with that in terms of our state processes. The change from the EFC to the SAI and the ability to go to a negative number will have some impact in terms of how we build our formulas and how we're able to award aid. We also want to make sure that this is an opportunity where we're taking a look at our formulas, our policies, our practices to make sure that all of the ways that we're awarding state aid are really congruent and consistent with both the letter and the spirit of the law coming through these FAFSA simplification changes. Now, we've obviously known for a bit that these changes are coming and have been doing a lot of work within the agency to try to make sure that we're both ready for it and that our primary stakeholder groups in terms of financial aid directors and students and families will have the information that they need about what these changes are and how it will likely impact them. So we've been working with stakeholders through surveys, through meetings, conversations to determine both what will be the likely impact of these new models, so who will benefit, who will potentially maybe not benefit as much, determining where there have been challenges in the past where maybe the way that we have awarded state grant aid hasn't been as consistent with some of the ways that Pell Grant has been awarded, and using this as an opportunity to fix those, which we'll talk in a bit more depth about here in a few minutes. We also wanted to make sure that we are starting to prepare both our campus financial aid directors and all of our outreach efforts to talk with students and families about these changes and how it might impact them. You know, we have talked about the importance of FAFSA completion and knowing that Minnesotans leave Pell dollars on the table by not completing the FAFSA. So this is also a really good opportunity for us to make sure that we're really talking about the benefits of completing FAFSA. Hopefully the fact that it's going to get easier will also encourage more students to complete it. And so we're working through with our stakeholders around how to message that and how to explain those upcoming changes. We also want to make sure that we are better serving part-time students, because we know that that's a really important population, especially in a time of declining enrollment, and looking at serving adult students who maybe have some college but no degree, or who are entering higher education for the first time. As I kind of hinted at earlier, there are some other changes that will be coming as part of this legislation. So the maximum amount of the Pell Grant will be increasing based on as these FAFSA changes are rolled out. Students will also be able to qualify for a minimum Pell Grant, which is 10% of the maximum, based on their family type and family adjusted gross income, even if they do not qualify based on their SAI. The long-term goal of this is to see more students become Pell Grant eligible, which is, I think, something that we certainly support in wanting to make sure students are accessing those federal dollars to fund their education. We do have some data that indicates that there will be some percentage of students, they think under 10%, who may actually see their Pell Grant amount go down as a result of these changes. And so that's where for the Minnesotans who are caught kind of in that moment, their state grant award may go up to compensate for their Pell Grant going down as we start working through these models. So we will see, our hope is that we'll see more Pell Grant eligible students and higher grant awards overall. Now I'll turn it over to you.
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself.
Hi, good morning, Chair Pawlowski and committee members. My name is Megan Flores, and I serve as the manager of state financial aid programs for the Office of Higher Education. We mentioned earlier, we wanted to bring to your attention some of the misalignment between federal aid policy and state aid policy as we anticipate it to be under the FAFSA simplification changes. Coming back to our Minnesota State Grant Program, which is our primary need-based program in the state of Minnesota, we're looking at how that really impacts these Pell changes and looking at our state policy, how we determine the shared responsibility formula for the state grant. And as you're aware from previous presentations through the Office of Higher Education, we split that price or that cost of education between three primary entities: the students themselves, families, unless it's an independent student where they're not having a parent information on the application, and then taxpayers. And the taxpayer share comes in large portion from the federal Pell Grant on the federal side, and then on the state side from the Minnesota State Grant Program. And so a variety of factors determine what a student receives in the Minnesota State Grant. Primarily that is the institution type that the student attends, as well as the number of credits they're enrolled per semester, what that needs analysis result is, currently called the EFC, but will shortly change to the SAI. And then the Pell Grant award level that a student receives is taken into account when we determine their state grant eligibility. So as mentioned, the state grant is our primary need-based state financial aid program. We do utilize the FAFSA application to streamline the process for students and families, so they use the FAFSA to apply. Our deadline is currently set at the 30th day of the term, so a student has to have their financial aid application submitted to the federal processor by the 30th day of the term. And then 84% of new resident undergraduate students are completing the FAFSA. So we do see a large volume of students completing the FAFSA, however, we definitely can improve that. As far as Minnesota residents, our state grant program is non-transportable, meaning that you do have to be a state resident to receive it, and you also have to be attending a Minnesota institution. We currently have 82 participating institutions, which includes public and private institutions, as well as private institutions that are licensed and registered through the Office of Higher Education. 59% of applicants do receive a state grant. And of those, 39% of resident undergraduates overall in the state of Minnesota do receive a grant. For our last fiscal year that we completed, we had about $210 million funding the program, and we saw about 117,000 applicants, with 69,000 of those receiving the grant award. As far as the impact for the state grant program, when we look at how these federal shifts and changes at the federal policy level will impact us, as was mentioned, we do anticipate that the Pell Grants will increase, that more students will have access to the grant. The eligibility will be expanded to more students, as well as the grants being a higher amount, and that's assuming that we will have modest changes in enrollment, wages, and the cost of college. In order for us to align our state statutory language with the federal language changes, we do need to address some of the conflicting language in statute where we reference the expected family contribution, beginning with the 22-23, next year will be 23-24. So 24-25 FAFSA year is when we need to have these changes in place and make sure anywhere in our state law where we reference the expected family contribution that we either replace that with the student aid index or we use a more general term, the federal needs analysis, for the results of the federal needs analysis, so that we have that alignment. This change in language not only impacts the state grant program, there are some other programs under the Office of Higher Ed's purview that we reference the expected family contribution. So we need to make some changes in the child care grant program, the Minnesota Indian Scholarship Program, as well as the foster grant program, to make sure that all of our state aid programs have the correct references in statute to reflect these federal changes. We also want to be very cautious of that in the past, as was alluded to by my colleague, that we didn't have a measure of needs analysis that went negative. We now will have that with this new federal change, and so we need to make sure that our state law is reflecting that and that it's holding students harmless, so that if we don't make language changes, it doesn't, you know, inadvertently cause negative detriment to those students and their awards. The cost for that, beginning with fiscal year 25, would be about $8.9 million. To make those federal changes. When we met with our stakeholder groups over the past year and a half, as we've been processing the changes at the federal level, one thing that we heard repetitively from the stakeholders as well as students is really trying to take this opportunity to better align state aid policy with federal aid policy so that the programs work a little bit more similar, and it's a little bit easier for aid administrators to explain the programs and how you get the program, how you become eligible, how long you can receive it for, and make them more similar so that it's easier for parents and students to understand, as well as for the students themselves to have long-term planning for the completion of their credential. In that light, we met with the groups, and a couple of things that came to light that really would better conform our grant program with the federal Pell Grant program would be to simplify the program and align the receipt of the grant for the state grant program with what the Pell Grant is, and that would be set to 180 credits of receipt of the grant, which is what the Pell Grant currently funds. Change would cost $21.2 million per fiscal year. The deadline is another issue that came up, especially for our aid administrators. The Pell Grant you can file through the end of the award year. With the state grant, you have to have it filed by the 30th day. So if you are enrolling a little bit later, or maybe don't quite understand the financial aid process and you apply on the 31st day, you cannot receive a state grant, but you can receive a Pell Grant. And in fact, the Pell Grant can be paid out through June 30th. So another ask of our stakeholders and students was to align those two dates so that the Pell Grant and the state grant would function more similarly, and that cost would be $12.7 million per fiscal year. Another area we've identified that we can better serve our students and our families is really aligning the calculation of that grant to part-time students. As you've heard, we do have quite a few students across the state that pursue higher education on a part-time basis, where they're enrolling less than 15 credits per term, and we really would like to align the way that that happens to reflect the way that the Pell Grant is awarded. The cost for that is very minimal. It would be $1 million per fiscal year. And then finally, the last change that we would like you to consider is an increase to the LME, the Living and Miscellaneous Expense Allowance. And this really reflects that living cost that we're hearing so much about students, where they're trying to meet their food and their rent and things like that. And changing that to be 120% of the poverty index beginning with fiscal year 24, and then 130% beginning with fiscal year 26. And the cost for that is $25 million per fiscal year, beginning in fiscal year 24, and then 47.8 beginning in fiscal year 26. And then this final slide we have here presented for you is kind of to have an overview for you to kind of see each of those changes that we've outlined and have it all in one spot so you can look at all of the various changes we've mentioned in the previous slides. And I'll just give you a moment to take a look at that. And then we are available for any questions that you might have.
Representative Hicks.
Thank you so much, Chair, and thank you so much for the presentation. I have a question about the better alignment for Minnesota aid to federal policy. Can you help me understand why there's a $12.7 million cost to allow students to apply until June 30th? Is that how many grants are being left on the table by the 30-day rule?
That would be...
Andrew Whalen? Let's please go through the chair.
Oh, I apologize. Chair, members of the committee, the difference would be that right now the deadline for a student to apply for the state grant is the 30th day of the term. So we did an analysis of students who have filed a FAFSA but did not meet that 30th day of the term and looked at if we had extended that deadline to match the Pell Grant deadline of the end of the year, what it would be.
Representative Hicks.
Great, thank you. That really makes me sad. Like, I'm super sad that there are a ton of students who missed out on $12 million of aid that they were eligible for because they didn't know how to fill out the application on time. I'm really sad. I thank you for that. That for me is just very eye-opening that I can't imagine being that student and how frustrating that must be for that young person.
Representative North.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick clarifying. I just wanted to know, what is the definition of Minnesota resident?
Manager Whalen or Assistant Commissioner, which one?
Thank you, Chair Pawlowski, Representative Knorr. I can answer that question. So in our state statutory law, there's actually 10 ways to be considered a resident student for the state of Minnesota. Probably I would say the primary way that most students become residents of this state is by graduating from a Minnesota high school. So that's probably the most common way, and probably second to that would be residing in the state for 12 consecutive months without enrolling as a half-time student or more, and you can establish residency in that way. We do have some other definitions that aren't as clear or probably a little bit more nuanced, being the spouse of a veteran, relocating directly to the state of Minnesota as a refugee, the Minnesota Dream Act, and I'm trying to think of the others. I think being... the disaster relief, yes. We commonly refer to that one as the Hurricane Katrina, but if you relocate to Minnesota directly from a natural disaster, because of that natural disaster, then you also can establish residency in that way.
Representative Knorr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think we need a clear guidance in terms of who is a Minnesota resident. There are a few folks who may be left out if they, for example, I think if you're taking part-time classes and you wanted to stay in the state of Minnesota, we're telling you that you're not a resident. Is that how I understood?
Chair Pawlowski, Representative Knorr, if you enroll at 5 credits or less, then you're a less than half-time student, and that would not impact that 12-month window that you have to establish residency. But if you relocate to the state of Minnesota from another state or country and within that first 12 months enroll 6 credits or more, then you do not establish residency. And the reason behind that is really that we're looking to see what is the primary reason that a student is here in the state of Minnesota. And so if they move to the state of Minnesota, immediately begin attendance, 6 credits or higher, our assumption would be that they moved here to attend college. And the intent of having that kind of 1-year waiting period would be that you establish residency. You know, you're likely paying property taxes or rent taxes or income taxes, contributing to the local economy and therefore receiving the benefits of that.
Representative North.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate it.
Anyone else have questions? Thank you. Members, we're six days away from the deadline. It's coming upon us very quickly. So you might want to keep these figures in mind, and I have some more figures for you. Yesterday, Senator Fateh and I received a letter from the University of Minnesota. They're going to increase their budgetary request to us by $97.5 million. We're going to send the letter out to you, but just as how they're going to do it, they are now asking for an American Indian Scholars Program. That would be $9 million over the biennium. An enrollment-driven tuition shortfall of $48 million over the biennium. This is what they term, I think, the COVID cliff, that students who attended their institutions the first 2 years of the pandemic are dropping off on the third year. And the one I find most interesting is the last one. They want a resident undergraduate tuition freeze of $40.5 million. So this would be an additional 97.5. We are going to have a hearing on this Tuesday, and they can explain exactly why this is coming at this time after we've spent 2 months doing mainly budgetary hearings. So I would hope that once you get the letter, you take a close look at it, you begin to prepare your questions for the hearing on Tuesday. Also on Tuesday, we are going to have a hearing on their request for approximately $1 billion for the medical school. So that will also be Tuesday. So Tuesday is going to be an interesting day. Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm pleased to hear we're having these hearings. And I wondered if you could request prior to the hearing that they provide us the documentation of the current agreement that goes till 2026 with the Fairview ownership of the properties, because I'd like to understand that agreement before the hearing.
I've asked Mr. Hopkins to do a brief review of the university and its history with its medical school. That might be part of his presentation. It wouldn't be, but we will then ask the university to provide that information. So, by the way, members, we will not be the only committee hearing their request. Health and Human Services probably will be, and it's likely the Commerce Committee will be too. So I've been told this is not going to be, I hope, out of our budget. It will come out of somebody else's.
Not mine, Mr. Chair.
Yes, we have a whole slew of people saying not mine. So we'll send you the letter. We'll get you as much information in advance, but I would come prepared Tuesday with questions. So we're at that point in session where we will start to be putting the budget together. I want to thank both of you, too. This is going to be part of our budget, and we appreciate the review and the numbers. Thank you both. Next on the agenda is House File 1121. 1121 comes at the request of the governor and the Office of Higher Ed. Are we right? Is it 1121? No. It's 1126, but on my notes it's 1121. So we'll change that to 1126. And when, as a chair, I put in a bill at the request of the governor, I have the governor's people come up to explain it. I don't. And why we are going to make a motion here to send it to the General Register, it's that time of session that we ensure there are certain bills in certain places. This bill could pass by itself, but it's likely also to be a vehicle bill that we may need in order to get our budget in order on the House floor. So with that, I'll make the motion that House File 1126 be recommended to pass and be put on the General Register. Director Oliver, I'm reminded now we have two amendments. So members, in your packet, we have Amendment A1. I will move Amendment A1, and Director Oliver, you want to explain Amendment A1?
Hi, for the record, my name is Nikki Oliver. I'm the Director of Grants and Government Relations for the Minnesota Office of Higher Education. I didn't grab the amendment, so I apologize.
Why don't we have someone get her the amendment?
Yeah, sorry.
Thank you.
Ms. Oliver, I think what I'll do is have House Research go over it for you, and we'll take a little stress off you today. So House Research.
Mr. Chair and members, the A1 amendment makes some conforming changes to changes that were already made to this bill in the Senate. These are just really technical changes that staff recommended in its review of the bill.
Any questions to the A1? Seeing none, all those in favor of the A1 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed, nay? The A1 amendment is adopted. I think we'll go to the A2, and as long as you're on a roll, Mr. Hopkins, go ahead.
Mr. Chair and members, so this just corrects a reference in the bill. It makes the it, it, it references the new exemption for tribal colleges and extends that into the Private Career Schools Act. So it just corrects a drafting error.
Any questions on the A2 amendment? Seeing no questions, all those in favor of the adoption of the A2 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay? A2 amendment is approved. The bill is now in proper form, and Director Oliver, it's all yours.
Thank you, Chair. So I will try to go through this quickly, but I know we have a lot of time, so I'll try to talk slower than normal. So section one, the first change is amending 135A.012, and that is the educational attainment goal reporting. Minnesota leverages alternative post-secondary education and training pathways to improve employability and overall outcomes. These programs, especially those leading to an industry-recognized credential, represents a critical outcome for the state workforce development and should therefore be included in the state's educational attainment goal. So this change is adding industry-recognized credentials to that reporting. Section two of the bill amends 136A.121, which is the state grant program and eligibility for grants. So this change aligns general student eligibility requirements to state financial aid with the federal financial aid. In federal law, a student who has been convicted of or has pled no contest or guilty to a crime involving fraud in obtaining student in student federal aid are then ineligible, so we feel like we should have that same standard for state financial aid. Section, section six, the next changes are to the fostering independence grants, so sections four. Section three is a data provision. So it is essentially closing a loophole for institutions to provide certain data. Currently in our law, institutions who participate in state or self-loan, I believe, am I correct, have to provide specific data. There are two institutions that participate in other state financial aid, and because they voluntarily share data, and it's not consistent with all the data we receive. So we're just making it so that if you participate, if you're an institution participating in any state financial aid program, you must also supply the same data. Section four is pertaining to the fostering independence grants, which Manager Megan Flores talked about a little bit before. This is just cleaning up that statute. That program was created, and there was some confusing language around like terms of receipt, eligibility, so that's cleaning up that language to make it clear for participants and institutions.
Director Oliver, Representative Hicks has a question. I think it's to this section.
Thank you so much, Chair. Thank you. I did want to just comment on E. This is so helpful. This particular grant program that just started has been wonderful for young adults in extended foster care or who were in care, but there's been a lot of anxiety amongst the youth around, well, what happens on year 3.5? What if I don't get into the nursing program on my first application? What if I can't go full-time because I'm raising a child, or because I have to work full-time because I don't have parents to fall back on and somewhere to go at Christmas and in the summer? And so this language makes me so happy. I am so happy about this language because it's going to relieve a lot of stress for young people who have been in our system and who rely on this, who are now relying on this wonderful program to make sure they can extend their higher education. So thank you.
An additional changes to the fostering independence grants is changing the opt-in date for institutions. I think when this program was created, there was just an arbitrary date put in there, which doesn't really work for a lot of institutions because they wouldn't know, specifically like the private institutions wouldn't really know their financial standing, as they're supposed to also help cover the difference in cost of attendance. So we are changing that date to allow them more time to know whether or not they'll be able to actually opt in. We also include hold harmless language for current participating students, so they are not. So if an institution that is currently participating decides they're not going to participate in the following year, students that were already participating in the program will not lose out on their financial aid going forward. So the next changes, and that's all section 4 and section 5, I believe. Section 6 through section 8 deals with tribal colleges. So this is to include in state statute a definition for tribal colleges in recognition of their unique and critical role of higher education in Minnesota. Tribal colleges provide a dynamic and culturally competent post-secondary education to students and whose contributions is not appropriately recognized in Minnesota policy. I know you all heard from the three tribal colleges a few weeks ago, and they expressed the same thing. Tribal colleges operate in Minnesota exempt from state authorization requirements under treaty law and qualify as public institutions by the U.S. Department of Education, but the role of state authorization for tribal colleges needs further clarification under state law. Currently, there is no language in our statutes that define tribal colleges. It confirms their exempt status, which is a little muddy by Public Law 280. And if you have questions about Public Law 280, we do have Betsy Talbot here, who is our licensing and registration manager, who can go into depth about all of that. And that tribal colleges can voluntarily register as a private college institution to be eligible for state financial aid under Chapter 136A.
So, Director Oliver, yep. You've checked with the tribal colleges, and they agree with this language. They have no problem with it.
Yes, we sent the draft language to the tribal colleges, and they're supportive. Tribal colleges and the students they serve will benefit from codifying the relationship between the state of Minnesota and the tribes. Additionally, the lack of distinction makes it and has made it hard to advocate for direct funding assistance to the tribal colleges because a lot of times there's confusion and they get equated with the private institutions. So by distinguishing tribal colleges in statute, it clarifies their establishment by sovereign nations, their exempt status, and their ability to participate in state financial aid programs without them being classified as a private college. Lastly, this proposal will give us direct statute to point to when referencing institutions and demonstrating the commitment to tribal sovereignty, which I know your staff likes that we can have a direct definition for tribal colleges when we reference them in other programs. Section 9, this is just simplifying and clarifying exemptions and aligns them with words that are more consistent with industry and just puts current practice in law. There are businesses, and we work with the Department of Labor and Industry, and the Department of Labor and Industry for apprenticeships. They are, certain businesses are exempt from having to be licensed and registered with our agency, and it just makes it clear in law that that exemption exists. So that's what we're doing here. Section 10, this is more or less technical in nature. We administer the concurrent enrollment grant program. There were several changes made to the program, and pieces were taken out, and there were pieces that were left in that kind of didn't make sense for implementation purposes. So there was an or, but there's only two ways in which an institution can apply for the grant, and currently in law it said it added a third, but that was, there was actually another piece to that originally, and the or shouldn't have remained there. Instead, we're changing that to an and for equity purposes. So for either of the two ways that a current concurrent enrollment program could apply, we're adding that they also should seek to recruit and retain underserved students into their program. And lastly are the repealers. So we're cleaning up statute, like I know you like, Chair Pawlowski. The first repeal is a repeal of rules that references a subdivision of 136A.823 that was actually removed in July of 2021. So the rule no longer applies to anything in statute, so we're repealing it. The other repealer is to a rule that establishes dates. Those dates are actually established in law, so there's no need for that rule that's in there.
And that was the, Director Oliver, that was the second
repealer. That was the second repealer, yes.
Right. Questions, members? Representative O'Neill, welcome back.
Thank you. It's been a rocky road. I appreciate that. Just really quickly on Section 8, you are repealing or making exempt, I guess, some of the requirements for reporting. Could you just mention the top things that are no longer being required for the tribal colleges?
Chair, Representative O'Neill, the exemptions, so we're not changing what current practice is. We're just providing a definition for tribal colleges. They already were exempt, but because they participate in state financial aid, they still have to abide by all the reporting requirements. Should they opt out of participating in state financial aid, then these exemptions would take place. As far as what's required in reporting, I could defer to a staff member, if that's okay.
Director Oliver, that's perfectly acceptable. Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Chair Pawlowski. My name is Betsy Talbot. I am the manager of institutional registration and licensing, so I'm responsible for administering these exemptions and the state authorization requirements of these schools. I believe the question is, what are they exempt from? So our practice is to recognize their sovereignty, and with their sovereignty, they have no registration requirements with their activities related to being a tribal college. Once you voluntarily register for state authorization, that subjects you to all of the requirements, all of the risk analysis requirements, program approval requirements, institutional review of their policies and procedures, and importantly, like the risk analysis, if we determine there is issues with the institution and a risk for taxpayer dollars, for example, for those state financial aid dollars, then we can put like surety requirements, et cetera, on them so that we can safeguard those funds just like any other institution, and then also safeguard students, require transcripts to be submitted if we're worried about the institution. Set expectations of them of certain quality and review that's Minnesota specific, not that's just required by the accreditor.
So, Neil.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Great. Can you let us know which of the tribal colleges have opted in, so that are currently receiving the state grants?
Chair Pawlowski, Representative O'Neill, currently it's Leech Lake and Red Lake are the two tribal colleges, because Fond du Lac is named in the Min State. Oh, and White Earth Tribal, sorry. So we have the three that we register, and then there's the fourth that's associated with the Min State campus, so we don't register them.
Thank you. Any other questions, members? Seeing no other questions, then I'll renew my motion that House File 1126, as amended, be recommended to pass and be placed on the general register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Members, I'm going to remind you about Tuesday. It would be good to have everybody here at the beginning and be prepared to ask questions. We're at that point of putting a budget together, and I want to make sure that we fully understand why the university is coming at now with a request of $97.5 million more as a base. Representative Cleborn.
Mr. Chair, I believe it's an indication that they listen to the committee. So,
Representative Cleborn, I believe it is too, but I'm glad you said it so the chair didn't. So, with that, meeting is adjourned.